Dear Dhamma friends, we were discussing Kaggavisana Sutta, which is available in the Kuddaka Nikaya. And this is one of the interesting suttas available in the Kuddaka Nikaya Sutta Nipata, where the seclusion, some noble seclusion, is fairly admired. Now, various suttas are there in the Sutta Nipata, as we discussed last time. These suttas are, even though the Sutta Nipata itself is somewhat not known to many people, but many suttas in it are very well known. Say, for example, you are quite aware of the Ratana Sutta, Karaniya Metta Sutta, Mangala Sutta. So all these are actually available in the Sutta Nipata. From that Sutta Nipata, various suttas are taken out, singled out, and then compiled as a Paritta chanting book. Or Paritta book. So many suttas were taken from the Sutta Nipata, and therefore it is considered one of the ancient books pertaining to the Buddha's teaching. And here in the Kaggavisana Sutta, the importance is that the seclusion is highly appreciated, highly admired here. Now again, the commentary says all these verses, what is available in the Kaggavisana Sutta, the Rhinoceros Horns Sutta, is attributed to a Pacheka Buddha. There are three categories of the Buddhahood, and the foremost one is the Sammasambuddha, the second one is the Pacheka Buddha, and the other one is the Sravaka Buddha. The Sammasambuddha is the person who self-enlightened and explained the Dhamma so that the others also able to realize the Dhamma, and so he has prepared or established a sasana, kind of a dispensation. There are many followers, so that is the typical Sammasambuddha. And there's another Buddha called Pacheka Buddha, sometimes called as Private Buddha, or where he also self-enlightened, but he can't explain to the level of a Sammasambuddha. So there are no many followers, there is no Sangha at that time. So this Pacheka Buddhas are self-enlightened and they live a secluded life. And the Sravaka Buddha is different. So he can't self-enlighten. So he is a follower of the Sammasambuddha, and he is in the sasana, the sangha order, the members of the followers of a Sammasambuddha, and then he also realized after hearing the Buddha's teaching and after practicing the Buddha's teaching, and he also sometimes able to explain to some extent the Buddha's teaching. So it depends on the individuals. Certain disciples are able to explain a lot, some are not. So for example, during the Buddha's time, Mahasariputta, who is the great disciple of the Buddha, and he was really able to explain the Dhamma in great detail. But on the other hand, there are certain other arahants like Mahakondanya, who actually didn't explain much. He actually spent a secluded life, even though he is the very first disciple who attained Sotapanna in this Gautama Buddha dispensation. So likewise, the caliber of the disciple vary, and depending on that caliber, so certain disciples are able to explain the Buddha's teaching, certain ones are not that able to explain the Buddha's teaching. So this Pacheka Buddha, on the other hand, self-enlightened, and they prefer to live alone. Now, we have been discussing this sutta for several weeks now, and we have come to a verse and which also talks about Pacheka Buddha according to the commentary. So here the verse going like this: Oropaitva gihi byanjanani sanchinnapatto yatha kovilaro chetvana viro gihi bandhanani eko chare kaggavisana kappu. Now here actually talks about how one becomes a monk. So actually the story was like there was one king, and he saw, his name is also given as Brahmadatta, and he is usually going to his royal park. So there was a royal park with many huge trees. This Kovilara tree is some sort of a tree which is given the Pali term as Kovilara. So there may be a biological term anyway. So this king used to go under that tree because it's a huge tree. It's with very good shade. And so he used to go under that tree and spend some time resting. So he is simply going through the park, going through the royal garden. And when he want to relax, so he go under this tree and spend some time. And after a couple of months, also he selected the same tree and he went there. And after a couple of months, again he went there. But the ministers understood now the tree has shed all the leaves. You know that the trees sometimes shed all the leaves, and ultimately the whole tree has no leaves at all. On this time, the king actually has ordered the ministers to arrange everything at the same place, because he used to that place and he is quite happy in that place. But he didn't know that the tree might have fallen all the leaves. But anyway, he has ordered the same place. So the ministers also, out of fear, so they arrange everything there. So ultimately, king also came there and he was so tired, and he started to rest. He fallen asleep here and he started to rest. And the others also have little went away. And now after a while, he woke up. The king woke up. And once he woke up, he understood there are no leaves at all. He is in the same, say, familiar place, under the familiar tree, but no leaves at all on the tree. Now the king start to think about this. So this is a kind of a mark, this which figures or triggers the king's mind. So he started to think, so this tree was a huge tree. This was filled with a lot of flowers, leaves, and it was so superb, splendid kind of a tree. But now what has happened? It has shed all the leaves. No, not a single leaf is available. Not a single leaf is available. Not a single flower is available. It's completely empty. It is so impermanent. So, my kingdom is also like that. My life is also like this. Now I have a lot of wealth, a lot of royal wealth, ministers, royal army, etc. The whole kingdom is mine. But don't know, in the future, I might have lost everything. So it is so impermanent. So he got the point of this impermanence. And he got the message from the tree. The tree was completely a blooming tree, and when it was several months ago. But now it's completely a empty kind of a tree. The whole tree appear like dried out. And so the king's mind aligned with the vipassana. So in order to start vipassana, in order to start kind of a reflection, so you need this kind of a triggering. So the king got this trigger by looking at the tree. It is an empty tree. No leaves, no flowers, no fruits. Just the kind of a dried out tree. Then he is mentioning, having discarded the marks of a layman, how about I too become a monk? Because the lay life is something like a lot of filled with various luxuries, and you are dealing with many possessions, and you are dealing with many other people. You are going to attend to the various parties. Nowadays anyway, things are a little different because of the pandemic. But the typical approach in the lay life is to be with many others, enjoying, laughing, eating, going here and there, And you are the more you have, more you happy. So that's the having abundant is the or having luxuries is the kind of a goal or the objective of the lay life. But now this king thinks in the opposite manner. He thinks, so this lay life is something like that. When I was experiencing this tree several months ago, but the monk's life is something like now, where the tree has nothing basically, or nothing. It's a kind of a simple life. So the king's thought process now has aligned into that monkhood, and again his mind was triggered by that impermanence. So that has made him awaken to certain insights of the vipassana practice. So when you have such kind of an awakening, when you have such kind of a triggering moment, so you start to reflect. So your mind go to some deep understanding. Your mind start to concentrate and come back to yourself. You start to ponder how I have spent my life. So you do some sort of a reflection. So the same thing happened to this king. So he is now doing a wise reflection. So he is now thinking, how about leaving the lay life? How about leaving aside this kingdom, this kingship, and to have become a monk? So he is now thinking, and he has started to sort of more consider about this impermanent nature of this whole phenomena. As a result of that, when he is reflecting again and again on this impermanence, his mind has concentrated. So this concentration was well aligned with the understanding. So with a very quiet, concentrated mind, he start to reflect about the body. And then he is able to attain Paccheka Buddhahood. And then actually the other people didn't know that now he is a Buddha. So the other ministers and all attendants, they after a while approached the king. Now he is a Paccheka Buddha, but still with the clothes, the king's clothes. And so they came and informed, great king, now it's the time to return back to the palace. Now the Paccheka Buddha is telling, no, I am not a king now, I am a Paccheka Buddha. So then the others are asking, Paccheka Buddhas don't look like this, I mean, you appear like a king. And then they ask, the king asks, Paccheka Buddha asks, how is the way of the Paccheka Buddhas? Then the others tell, okay, they are wearing a robe and they are staying secluded. So likewise, they started to explain. And immediately the whole thing has changed and he got all the powers and he went away from all these people. Now he is completely secluded and he is the full-fledged Paccheka Buddha. So basically, this story, in a way, sort of gives some sort of a comparison between the monk's life and the lay life. So typically, the success of the lay life is considered based on the material wealth. So if you have several cars, if you have say several houses, maybe a very good or large garden, lot of properties, and many say huge amount of money on your bank account, several credit cards, a very good designation and very good social status, very good reputation, and your children are well educated. So many things are there to evaluate the success of a lay life. But on the opposite, the monk's life, the quite successful monk's life basically has very less possessions. So more a monk has, far from the monkhood. So I can remember Venerable Kadavadwe Jinavansa Mahathero. So he is the founder of this whole Yogashrama Sanstha, to where Nisarnavane and various other forest monasteries are belonging to. So he actually differentiates these two sites. And he mentioned very beautifully, the lay life which doesn't have anything, completely poor. Say you don't have your house, you don't have enough money to live, you don't have any occupation, any job to do, and you are begging from others, you are taking many loans. So basically this kind of a lay life is not a successful lay life. On the other hand, if you are not in debt to anyone and you have say very good remuneration and your children are well educated and you have a good wife and children and enough wealth is there and a lot of properties are there and you are fairly a very reputed person. So these are the points we can say, okay, he is leading a very successful lay life. But on the other hand, Venerable Kadavadji Jinavansa Mahathero, he beautifully says, now this is the wealth of the lay life. But the opposite is true to a monk's life. Now if a monk has all these things, so he has many temples, many monasteries to look after, say many students to look after, many wealth to look after, and he is maintaining several accounts, he has his own private money, and he has many robes, lot of properties, several cars, etc. So Venerable Kadavadi Jinavasa Mahathero mentioned, he is not a rich monk, rather he is the poorest monk. Because the monk's life is going on the complete opposite manner. So he say, a rich monk is a person who basically own nothing. Basically Buddha has mentioned that the monks should have very basic requisites. So those basic requisites are very well written, very well informed. For example, for a Upasampada monk, so the Buddha mentioned having double robe, single robe, and the inner robe, the antaravasaka, and the ball. So those are the four main requisites one should have, a monk should have. Everything else are additional. So if he has a kuti, if he has a monastery, if he has a temple, so if he has slippers, if he has additional, say, robe, if he has devotees to help, if he has medicine, so all these are quite secondary. So what is essential is the three robes and the ball. So those are the must in a way to have. Everything else is something additional. So more a monk has, more burden he is. So therefore the monk's life is going against the grain. So monk's life is completely opposite to the lay life. If a monk has very, very less possessions, he is a rich monk. On the other hand, if the lay person has very, very little thing, he is a poor person. So therefore, this comparison is very interesting. And you can understand, as we are moving forward, so similar thing happens in the mind as well. Now, even you are a lay person, even if you have a lot of possessions, but when you are get on to the meditation, the mindfulness practice, you may understand. So, thinking about all these possessions, all these liabilities, all these responsibilities, is kind of a burden. So, your mind has no any kind of satisfaction. Because more you have, more you trouble. You have to trouble every time. You have to sort of responsible for many things. So the always mind is crowded. Always mind is burdened. Many responsibilities. So on the other hand, if you are maintaining only the essential items, if you are quite frugal and maintaining only the essential items, then you understand, okay, mind is somewhat relaxed. Because you only have very basic requisites to take care, and you don't need to worry about so many things, so you have enough time now, so you have kind of a fairly satisfied life if possible. So therefore in Dhamma it is mentioned, santutti paramandana. So contentment is the great wealth. Typically, till our mind has craving, we are never satisfied. Either you are a layman or either you are a monk, you will never be satisfied till the craving is available in the mind. Craving is the one which is governing the mind. So till that, you don't feel completely satisfied. You may have many things. As a layman, you may have many things. As a monk, I may have many things. But till the craving is sort of overpowering, craving is predominant in the mind, never satisfied. Always feel unsatisfied. Always feel something lacking. Not fulfilled. But if we are continuing our practice and we are able to fade away this craving, keep aside the craving, not to become a slave to this craving, then we are looking our life in a different angle. Then we understand it is not the satisfaction of craving the proper solution. You know, there are various cravings are there, various desires are there. So what typically people do is to satisfy those desires. Suppose you want to have a very good car, so you sell your old car and you are going for a new car. Say if you want to enjoy very delicious food, so you go to a, say, popular hotel and you enjoy, order very good meal and you enjoy. So whatever the desire comes in the mind, so immediately you are trying to fulfill it, trying to satisfy it. But in this scenario, are these desires going to reduce, or to completely satisfy? Then never. And even though you have satisfied yesterday's desire, today also the same desire may arise. And you are again going to satisfy the same desire. Tomorrow also the same desire may arise. So you are going to satisfy the same desire. So satisfying desires, therefore, will not completely give the solution. More you satisfy, your desired expected level may even increase. Suppose you are happy today with a couple of dollars, and once you have it, tomorrow you need more in order to have that same satisfaction. Say after a couple of months, you need even more to have such satisfaction. So that our expected levels are continuously increasing. So people are never satisfied, even they have the best opportunities, best wealth, because their expectations are quite high. So if we consider nowadays, so people have many things, unlike the good old days. The good old days, the people's lives are very simple. Assume that we in Sri Lanka, we were completely dependent on the agricultural society, and they were doing, the paddy farming. And so they are going to the paddy field and they do the ploughing, and they were working hard, and they were able to get good harvest, and they enjoyed their family life. They shared that wealth, and they were quite contented, quite happy. But nowadays, now we have many vehicles, a lot of industrial, applications. You have a cell phone, you have a camera, and you have a telephone. You have a TV, you have a piano, whatever it is. So many, many things are there, still not satisfied. So many completed things are there, various luxurious things are there, but still people are not satisfied. So we need to think in a way, so where are we going? So is it the development that always that we think, all this material development, will it give us enough satisfaction? So this is the dream that we are actually dreaming. Now the poor countries are dreaming to become a rich country. Poor countries are dreaming to have very good infrastructure, because they think that the very long lead highways and many-story buildings, and all these things are the wealth of the country, and that is what the prosperity means. And so all countries are going after that model. And the countries which already have achieved that, are they really satisfied? Are they all those all people living 100% happy? So they seems not, because if you consider many wealthy countries, so they have many issues. So once certain basic requirements are satisfied, then there are another set of requirements arise. Now they want to maintain that status, they want to become the superpower, and they want to maintain that, and the people are still not satisfied, so they want more freedom, so they are not ready to listen to the, say, the private laws, so the public laws, so they want more and more. Still the unrest is there, people are again struggling. So likewise, even though we are satisfying the basic needs, still people are not satisfied. So therefore, satisfying desires is not the approach that Buddha is talking. Rather, finding the causes of the desire and eliminating the desire is the path that Buddha is taking. It is not the satisfying desires as the solution, rather freedom from desire is the solution. So you are trying to find out causes why these desires are arising. What are the causes for these desires to arise? So rather than satisfying desires, now you are trying to eliminate the causes of the desire. So you are trying to uproot the desire. So that is kind of a radical approach, because always the typical approach is to satisfy desires, to fulfill desires. But the Buddha is talking about eliminating desires, to uproot the desires. So when there are no desires in the mind, so the mind feels contented. So this is, in a way, it's a kind of a radical approach. So assume that you are going to a supermarket. And when you go to a supermarket, so everything is very well displayed. Everything is very colorful. So they have used the best kind of marketing methods. So even though your list had only, say, 50 items to buy, so ultimately if you had enough money, so you buy 150 items. Because many things were there. Once you are going around the supermarket, so many, many things are sort of inviting you to buy. So the packaging, wrapping and everything is so beautiful. So you are compelled to buy. But suppose you are going through the whole supermarket, but you didn't buy anything. Because your house has everything, you are happy and everything is there. Say your fridge has enough food and everything is there. But assume that you went through anyway through the supermarket, but you didn't have any desire to buy anything. So you are simply looking around, but you didn't buy anything. Not because that you didn't have money, but there is no desire arising in the mind. So then you feel, okay, I went through the whole supermarket, I had enough money to buy, but no desire has arisen in the mind and asked me to buy. So it's a kind of a different approach. So there you feel, okay, I feel contented. So mind feel happy, internally happy. Not that mind is asking to be happy by going through some external triggering. Now we think that the external, requisites are the ones make us happy. So that's why we are buying more and more things. So in order to satisfy the eyes, we are buying something. In order to satisfy ears, we are buying something. In order to satisfy nose, we are buying something. In order to satisfy the tongue, we are buying something. In order to satisfy our body, we are buying something. So likewise, we are continuously trying to gratify these senses. But even though you have enough opportunity to buy, if there is no desire to buy, and you feel completely fulfilled, contented, So that's a different approach. So therefore Buddha mentioned santutti paramang dhanam. So if one feel contented, so that is the greatest wealth. So internally you are happy, internally contented, and you feel satisfied. So this is where Buddha's teaching is helping us to approach. So when you are more and more trying to live mindfully, trying to be happy internally, and your mind is not going after various things, rather mind is quite happy within yourself, so then you are coming to this kind of a dimension where mind is not asking anything. Mind doesn't want anything. And mind is happy still. Even though it doesn't ask anything, it does not mean it is unhappy. Internally it is happy. Even though it is not asking anything, it is not asking anything new from the outside, because internally it is feeling complete. Internally it is feeling fulfilled, satisfied. So this is a different kind of a scenario that Buddha is explaining. So this is something that we need to ponder, or we need to reflect how to have such kind of an internal contentment, feeling happy, feeling satisfied internally, not going after all these sensual gratification. So this is something that we can think of. And with that invitation, with that direction, I like to conclude today's Dhamma sermon. Now I like to open the session for questions.
I listen to Nivana Nivima Dhamma Deshana at times. And my question is, what is the book Bhante that you read and Venerable Loku Swamin Wansa explains afterwards? Who wrote this book? When was it written? It's amazing to listen to. Much appreciation and merits to all Bhantes with Metta. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, so that book is written by Most Venerable Katukurunde Jnanananda Mahatero, and it is written several years ago, and actually it was a very interesting book, and the invitation actually happened from the Most Venerable Mathura Sri Jnanarama Thero. Actually at that time Mathura Sri Jnanarama Thero was the chief meditation master and the abbot of the Nisarnavane. And Venerable Katukurunde Jnanananda Mahathero was the deputy, and he was also living in the Nisarnavane. And Venerable Jnanarama Mahathero made a sort of an invitation to Venerable Katukurunde Jnanananda Mahathero to deliver a series of lectures or series of sermons taking the Nibbana as the topic, because there were many misunderstandings about the Nibbana. So some people were thinking Nibbana only possible after the death, and you can only achieve it in this different manners. And even who attain arahantship has many different things. So like a different types of misconceptions were there around Nibbana. So Venerable Jnanarama Mahathero understood, so this Venerable Katukurunde Jnanananda Mahathero has the skill to explain Nibbana very well. So he invited Katukurunde Jnanananda Mahathero to deliver a series of sermons. At the beginning, Jnanananda Mahathero was quite reluctant because it's a kind of a challenging task. But again and again, Jnanarama Mahathero has persuaded him. So ultimately he agreed. And he delivered 33 sermons on Nibbana. So all these 33 sermons are available in the Seen Through the Net website. And again, the book what we are reading on every Tuesday is also available. So I am putting that linked to the chat box, so you all can go through it. Seen Through the Net .net. That is the website, and you can find all the Sinhala books and the English translations. The translations are also done by Most Venerable Katukurunde Jnanananda Mahathero. And he's a very academic, a scholar, as well as a meditator. And it's a combination of both where they are. Not only a scholar, but also a very good practitioner. So he was able to deliver these 33 sermons. Yeah.
Session number 2 of 5. Mindful sitting. Dear Bande, during the last 3 to 4 months, I did not get any chance to practice sitting mindfulness. This is mainly due to a lack of seclusion and isolation I could find since all the members of the family are at home, including the children. Last year, it was not so bad as I could find 1 or 2 spots in the morning where everyone in the household was out, so that I can practice sitting at least 1 to 2 hours continuously. Therefore, my practice these days are mainly being vigilant on the thoughts while engaging with others and doing walking outside the house wherever possible. Since I've practiced several years under yours and Bhante Dhammajiva's guidance, I feel fortunate that I can use whatever the mindfulness practice I have developed in this time. During day-to-day activities, when I engage with others, I can observe how the mind reacts to various inputs and situations. Anger, lust, frustration, fear, liking, and disliking seem to rise and fall all the time, and leaving traces of different trails in the mind. I feel these trails as a form of pressure or stress in the mind, against the relaxed, non-attached, expanded mind I have experienced during the sitting practice some time back. This relaxed state was observed after the breath faded away completely and mindfulness was established without any focused central object. For some reason, this is the background mind state or the reference I use to compare the state of the mind during observations of thoughts and various feelings. I have never done mindfulness of thoughts and feelings specifically. Thus, thought of checking if this is the correct practice. With metta, that's the end of the question.
Yeah, actually, I can agree with you. Basically, so this is where we practice, or rather, practically do our practice. So when you do some formal practice, say you are going to a secluded place, sitting cross-legged and paying your attention to in-breath and out-breath, and you are trying to recognize various feelings, etc. So this is the kind of a formal practice. But that practice, so those skills that you have developed through such formal practice has to be applied in the day-to-day activities. So that is what you have done. So you already have practiced to some extent and were able to develop some amount of skills. And now you are applying those skills in various activities. And one important activity is the observation of the mind. So this observing the mind actually has to be an ongoing task. So it actually naturally will happen. So you start with Kayanupassana, paying correct attention, enough attention to the body, and developing various skills. So as you are continuing, automatically you may have a trend to look at the mind, and that skill is slowly developing, and you may start to watch the mind. What are the moods I am going through? What are the emotions arising? Am I becoming emotional? Am I happy? Am I desperate? So am I unhappy? So likewise, sort of different mind states start to appear, or you start to be mindful about those kind of different states, mind states. So that's an outcome of the practice, and then you actually can use those states as a input to the practice. So now you are practicing Cittanupassana, where you are continuously observing the mind and continuously on guard, on check the mind. So you are not overcome or overpowered by those various kinds of emotions. So you are, when assume that there is a lustful thought arising, so you are aware of it. When an angry thought arising, you are aware of it. So this is how we are, in a way, further refining our practice, further strengthening our practice. So you are doing well. But anyway, time to time, having your secluded time or seclusion is also necessary. So don't forget that. So it's necessary to have kind of a privacy, necessary to have a seclusion. So you do some sort of an introspection, you look at yourself and what is the state of the mind, is it properly or very clear, am I not crowded with various thoughts, is the mind maintaining enough clarity so that I can continue my practice. So those reflections, introspections are possible when you have some time for your own. Therefore, that side is also has to be maintained. Yeah.
Question number 3 of 5. This is a general question. Dear Venerable Bhante, last week there was a great question from someone regarding the observation of attraction to sensual pleasures even during the times when we practice mindfulness. Due to your excellent guidance and techniques, I don't have any major issues with the practice and are quite satisfied with the way it is developing. However, day by day, I feel dispassionate. In my work, disgusted about the way my mind works and how it attracts to lust, greed, and also how easily anger and aversion builds up. Based on your teachings, I understand this is the first step where mindfulness shows how mind works and how we react as an internal mirror. But I'm really astonished how powerful these attractions and rejections are and wondering if at any time I can be freed from them. From outside, I maintain a very disciplined, exemplary life and honestly haven't engaged with anything bad for years. However, inside, it is not so pure and I have many cravings, lust, aversions and thought patterns which are not suitable for spiritual well-being. How can one continue with the practice while knowing that we are living with a cancerous wound? Thank you for your valuable insights. That's the end of the question.
So this is actually a very honest reflection. So even though, so we are monks, so still we have, say, not sort of, we can say some unsuitable or say lustful, angry, deluded thoughts. So we are not arahants. But we have to honestly accept that. So, and we don't need to make it mine. So that is the kind of a distinction that Buddha is asking to develop. So we are able to distinctly recognize these are thoughts. I don't need to claim them as mine. And as we are able to disengage from these thoughts, so that is the key in the Chittanupassana. So if you can remember Chittanupassana, how Buddha explained, Saragan Chittam Saragan Chittanti Pajanati, Vitaragan Chittam Vitaragan Chittanti Pajanati, Sadosan Chittam Sadosan Chittanti Pajanati, Vitadosan Chittam Vitadosan Chittanti Pajanati. So when lustful thought arise, so the practitioner recognize it as a lustful thought. It is not my lustful thought, it is a lustful thought. When an angry thought arising, so he recognize this is an angry thought. It is not my angry thought, rather it is an angry thought, that's it. So looking at these various thoughts objectively is the key. So don't try to make them yours. So have this kind of a distant observation. So thoughts are arising, lust arising, anger arising, delusion arising, jealousy arising. But you are able to disengage from that. You are able to step back from that. And you are not claiming them as mine. You are not identifying with them. You are not being a slave to them. But they still arise. Can't help. So the moment we are able to disengage, the moment we are able to be mindful about them, they lose their grip. And we are not promoting them. So we are not the poor victims of them. We are not slaves to them. As a result of that, they start to fade away. So again and again, this kind of a practice has to be applied. So assume that you are continuing like this. Again and again, you are honestly recognizing lust is arising. Honestly recognizing anger is arising. You continue the practice. Still, I mean, you may not feel blissful. So we are now actually looking at the various thoughts merely as thoughts. So we are not identifying with them. Rather, we are able to disengage from them and looking at them objectively. So this is where we are able to have a sort of distant observation, disengaged observation. So when we do that, so these different kinds of habits, traits, lust, hatred, delusion, say avarice, envy, jealousy, all these different types of things. So they don't get enough strength to continue. So they continue only if we identify with them, only if we claim that they belong to me. The very moment that we are able to disengage from them and looking at them objectively, so they lose their power and they start to fade away. So likewise, again and again, we have to honestly look at, honestly recognize these different types of thoughts and watch them, observe them, mindful about them and allow them to fade away. As we continue like this, so they may start to slowly weaken. So likewise, we have to weaken this whole different kinds of defilements. So that is the only way that we can go through. Ultimately, they may completely uprooted, but it is not happening immediately. So therefore, don't expect quick results. Rather, the practice is very gradual. And in a way, we can say it is quite slow. Yeah.
Question number 4 or 5. This one is mindful sitting. Dear Bhante, during today's guided session, I tried to focus on my abdominal movement as per the instructions. My usual meditation object is the breath, and I can establish mindfulness fairly easily using the breath. Since I have some experience on mindfulness practice, thought of using abdominal movement today. However, after a few minutes, the breath appeared, superseding the subtle abdominal movement as one and was in the process of settling down. I tried to focus again on the abdominal movement and the same result. After a few cycles, I settled with the breath and continued with the practice. Thought of writing my experience and checking with Bhante. With metta, that's the end of the question.
Yeah, no harm. So basically, when you are capable of keeping breath as your primary object, you can switch back to the breath and say time to time, I mean, not necessary in a way, it's not necessary at all to go to the rising and falling. You can continue in mindfulness on breathing. But later, sometimes if you are switching to the elements meditation, probably you can recognize rising and falling also as a phenomenon of air element, kind of a manifestation of air element. So here today in your practice, you switching back to your normal breathing practice is quite acceptable, no problem.
Question number 5, I think this is the last one. General question. Bhante, regarding today's Dhammadipa sermon, during the practice, many of us come through the state where mindfulness can be established without any object or attaching to any sense bases. Is there a link, or does this continuous practice help us to reduce craving? That's the end of the question.
Can you repeat the last sentence?
Sure. Is there a link, or does this continuous practice help us to reduce craving?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. Because, say, when your mind is not attached with anything, so when your mind is objectless, so that indicates that the mind is not become a slave to any craving. So when you are able to maintain unattached mind, quite detached mind, a mind which is not established anywhere, so that means it is free from craving. It's temporary but free from craving. So if you are able to maintain that even with less effort, so that indicates you have some subsided craving. Craving is not coming to the front. Craving is weaker at that moment. More we are able to maintain an unassociated, unattached, undefiled, relaxed state of mind, that on the other hand indicates your craving has weakened and subsided. So, but anyway, time to time craving might arise, so that again the mind go and attach. So at that time, you have to clearly recognize it. Mindfulness has to show that. And as a result of that, you should be able to let him go that desire. So that is the point. We are sort of weakening the defilements. So we are weakening the craving. Because we didn't support that mental pattern. We didn't support that habitual tendency. Rather, we recognize it very quickly and able to leave it aside. So this is the practice that we need to continue. And then it will lead to sort of weaken various types of defilements and maybe, hopefully, ultimately, completely uproot all the different types of defilements. And that's why Buddha mentioned. Actually, even today's Sinhala Dhamma sermon, also I have explained that very well. So I invite you to listen to that Sinhala Dhamma sermon also. I will upload that in a couple of hours. And so there also Buddha very well explained that maintaining such unassociated mind, maintaining that non-grasping mind, indicate the mind is free from desire, indicate that the mind is not afflicted with craving. And such mind has to be further enhanced. How we are going to enhance? By keeping very natural kind of a mind. Keeping very shallow concentration. So that mind, if mind has the potential to attach, it will go and attach. But your mindfulness will show you, indicate that. And at that time, you are trying to let go that desire. And again, return back your practice to that emptiness, to that unattached state. So likewise, again and again, these different types of defilements has to be recognized and have to be let go of. Yeah.
That's the last question, I think. Let me just check. Yeah. So I'd like to conclude. We're a little bit early, but we'll finish up. I'd first of all like to thank Bhante for giving up valuable time for this program and also passing on our merits. I'd also like to thank the people who are working behind the scenes to make this program happen, as well as those people seen and unseen participating. And last of all, to the participants, because without you, there would be no program. With that, I'd like to end the session. Teruan Sanai.
Yeah, Teruan Sanai.